Good evening. It is Tuesday, January 10th, 2012. It's been a while since we've had one of these classes, and particularly the Fundamentals of Judaism class, and I was away last week, so welcome back. We were up to a class that I called The Varieties of Rabbinic Fallibility. And I figured this was a little more of an interesting way of phrasing it as opposed to, oh, are rabbis fallible? The answer is obviously yes. But I thought it would make things a little more interesting to see a few different dimensions of what examples or precedents do we have of rabbis making mistakes or erring in one way or another. Continuing our theme in terms of setting up what our core premises are in the focus. The premise that we're basing on today, that we set up in the last class, was that rabbis represent an extension of divine authority in terms of being able to interpret the divine law in a way that makes the constituents of the followers of rabbinic authority religiously bound. How do we define that? But the focus, that we're going to discuss is, well, if rabbis do in fact represent an extension of divine authority, rabbis, though, are also human. And as humans, subject to making certain mistakes. So our focus today are going to be, the varieties, and we'll keep in the back of our minds, what would some of the implications be for Jewish law, depending on what sort of mistakes are made. And I put together four different categories. I didn't give every single example, but suffice to say, we'll do this one step at a time. So, start us off. The first category of mistakes that rabbis can make, and by rabbis, the sources all that I'm citing here are from what we call rabbinic sources. I know that sounds like a bit of redundancy, but I mean focusing on, what we call the rabbinic texts of Mishnah and Gemara. Both Bavli and Yerushalmi. And the logical implication is going to be that if the rabbis who were the ones responsible for really developing and concretizing what we consider rabbinic Judaism, we have evidence of certain mistakes either in practice or in theory, an acknowledgement of such mistakes that can be made, certainly the rabbis today are not going to be that much significantly better. Almost a kal vachomer, that if rabbis in the Talmud can make mistakes, pretty much any rabbi can make a mistake. And here are a couple of ways how. So the first category that I have is what I call mitziyut, which would mean mistakes in understanding reality. Here is, I think, one of the more well-known examples from a Gemara in Shabbat 107b. Take the Cincino translation, please.
But other abominations, etc. But if one kills them, he is kovel, which Tana holds it up, said Rabbi Jeremiah, this Rabbi Eliezer. For it is taught, Rabbi Eliezer says, he who kills vermin on the Shabbat, it is though he has killed a camel on Shabbat. Rabbi Joseph demurred to this. The rabbis disagree with Rabbi Eliezer only in respect to vermin, which does not multiply and increase. But as for other abominations and creeping things, which multiply and increase, they do not differ.
Right. So it gets a little bit lost in translation here. But in the Hebrew side, it's, Ella Bikina. There's an argument here on killing certain living organisms on Shabbat, whether or not that constitutes the prohibition against killing. And these things called kina, right? De'ina paravaravat. It says here that do not multiply and increase. Literally, it really means they do not reproduce biologically, in the sense that they more spontaneously generate. Now, we know this to be false, and there's a great deal of discussion on this and other topics about rabbis getting science wrong, which happens not infrequently, particularly in the realm of biology. The end of the third chapter of Ketubot has some, let's just say, scientifically disproved statements about the female anatomy. You've got statements of medical, care that just don't seem to work. You have a discussion of kamea in Gemara and Shabbat, of a certain type of amulet used for healing purposes. All such things, that I call here mistaken reality, are based on at the time, it might very well have been the best that their idea of science had to offer. Today, however, we know better. And statements such as these, today, by our scientific definition, we can call these mistakes. They erred. The way that they thought the world worked is not the way that we know the world works today. It's a mistake that's important to realize, especially when you get to contemporary questions, anything involving science or technology. There were some responses that I know we discussed, and like my first year here, gave a few classes on electricity, and there were some opinions that explained when they were trying to figure out electricity on Shabbat, clearly did not understand how electricity works. And it is an issue that comes up in Psak, for all such things, that if you want to know, Rav Tendler used to, give muster about this. He said, if you want to, be a shofar, you have to know the anatomy of an animal. You have to know biology in order to know the trefot. If someone asks you a question about technical stuff, sometimes you actually have to take it apart, understand how exactly does it work, and does it work if people say that it works. Not everyone does that, and when you don't do that, or even if you do that but you're just missing something because you happen not to be an expert in that particular field, you're going to be susceptible to making mistakes. And it's important to acknowledge that this does exist in the Gemara, and it persists today and not just for science, but whenever you make when someone asks you for a decision, we'll get to the halachic issues, in another section here. But if someone asks you a halachic psak of a question of what's the halach in this particular case, you have to know the mitzvot. You have to know what is the reality in front of you. And people can dispute here's how it works, or that's how it's. Even if you agree on what the halacha is, right, you might disagree that this particular instance in front of you is, matches one halacha or doesn't match another one. It's an important point, and it's an important point to realize that it is an area in which rabbis can make mistakes. And it's important to realize that even though it is not intrinsically halachic, it does have halachic ramifications. Right? Because whether or not, electricity itself is not a halachic concept, but if you want to discuss, what is electricity on Shabbat, you have to know what electricity is, even if we all agree on what the halachot of Shabbat are, which is rarely a given. You have to know what electricity is in order to paskin correctly. Mm-hmm. All right? So that's category one. I only gave one example for that.
So does that mean we can kill bugs on Shabbat, or how did this get resolved?
You mean in terms of if you have a kina, one of the kina, how do you, are you allowed to kill it? I'd still recommend against it. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
I will throw in that a friend of mine asked a fun question. Are you allowed to kill a mosquito on Yom Tov? A friend of mine asked one of the rebbeim in Gush about this. And the logic being that, you're allowed to, do melachot on Yom Tov for ochel nefesh.
Uh-huh.
Things, for purposes that you can eat, which would include shechita, which would include killing. So since killing is technically permitted in general, then you should be allowed to kill mosquitoes. The rabbi that was asked still said no. But he liked the question.
It's funny, that is something that reminds me of a Yom Tov on Sukkot. I once had, this was some years ago in Toronto, and I had both Sukkot Kiddush and Sukkot lunch on Rabbi Sukkot that were just crawling with bees.
Mm.
I wasn't going to be the first to kill one.
You're not supposed to. One of my jobs setting up the circa, back when the family was all together, was setting up bee traps. Also, if anyone's listening, if you have trouble with ants and your table's can hold this, I got this from a cousin in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You put the legs of the table in in a plastic cup of water. You just fill the water a little bit, and it serves as a moat, and that way the ants can't climb up the legs. So any bugs you'd find would have to fall down from the sock. Nice little bonus for you there. But again, you'd have to set that up before Shabbos, or Yom Tov. Anyway, so that's category one. Category two that I call is mistaken practice. And by mistaken practice, I mean I should say this. I don't mean that rabbis do averot, because the truth is, rabbis do averot. You know, there's no man who does all good and doesn't say in the name of them. Teddy Bartz, no one is going to be perfect. Right? So we're not talking about, you know, someone who has, you know, various indiscretions. But even someone who acts in a way not in accordance with halacha, even though that person might think he is. To give just one example of this in rabbinic literature is the source being Mishnah and Bracha 1:3. There's a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel regarding Kriyat Shema. Beit Shammai says, in the evening, every man should recline and recite the Shema, and in the morning he should stand. As it says, when you lie down and when you rise up, B'shachbecha uv'kumecha. The way Beit Shammai interprets this is B'shachbecha uv'kumecha refers to your physical orientation. That Shach means at night you should actually recite Kriyat Shema lying down, and in the morning, uvkumecha, you're supposed to say Kriyat Shema specifically standing up. Beit Hillel, however, disagreed. He said that every man should recite in his own way, meaning if you happen to be, as it says, and when you walk by the way, because uvalechtecha bederach, however you happen to be, meaning if you happen to be standing, you happen to be sitting. So what does it mean then, uvashapachov kumecha, lie down and get up? So it means at the time when people lie down and at the time people rise up. So whereas Beit Shammai explained the two words, shapachov kumecha, lying down and getting up, as referring to your physical orientation, Beit Hillel interprets this as a matter of time. Okay, it's an important background for the case. Rav Tarfon said, I was once walking by the way, and I reclined to recite the Shema in the matter prescribed by Beit Shammai, meaning he was going on the path. Beit Shammai said you're supposed to be lying down, and he wanted to be machmir, he wanted to actually fulfill the words of Beit Shammai by lying down. And he says, and I incurred danger from robbers. They said to him, you deserve to come to harm because you acted against the opinion of Beit Hillel. That's the language of the Mishnah.
So
not there yet. Before we do that, I want to do the Yerushalmi, because Yerushalmi is a little bit more harif here. Rav Abba Bar Kon, in the name of Yehuda ben Pazi, said, know that the words of the sages are more special than the words of the Torah. Tidalach shechavivin divrei sofrim divrei Torah. Sheherei Rabbi Tarfon ilu lo kara lo haya over ela ba'aseh. Had Rabbi Tarfon not recited the Kriyat Shema, he would have only violated not doing a positive commandment. Ba'al yedei she'avar al divrei Beit Hillel, but because he went against the words of Beit Hillel, nitchayev mita. He was worthy of death. And I wanted to read that in the Hebrew for those, you know, who couldn't follow along in the recording here. Use that idiom in Yushalmi Nitchayev Mita. So you have a case here of Rabbi Tarfon, right, Tana, we could, you know, I think of the grand scheme, a fairly great rabbi, who acted inappropriately in terms of, in, you know, this case maybe being more chamur, wanting to follow Beit Shammai neged halacha, initially thinking it was correct, right? It's not a matter of, you know, sitting head of yetzer or hara. It's not like saying, oh, you know, I, you know, felt the need to eat trefer, you know, eat non-kosher food or something like that. It's like he wanted to follow Beit Shammai, and he was held accountable by his colleagues for that. Point being, not everything that a rabbi does is correct. All right? Comments?
So, one question I have is, why, and I realize they're somewhat beside the main point, but why is he... Why, if Hillel says you should do it, recite in your own way, so why isn't following Shammai's strategy policy consistent with Beit Hillel's? I mean, it sounds like Beit Hillel is saying you can do whatever you want.
That's an that's a very good point with that too. I'm subject of a much longer discussion because the two are not mutually exclusive, mind you. The point of the Gemara here, though, would be, you're right, because you could, in theory, do both. You recite at the proper time. The language you're used is Rabbi Tarfon. It said here, "V'itati likrot k'divrei Beit Shammai." The reason why he wanted to do it was to fulfill what Beit Shammai said. And the objection is, once halacha is determined like it's Beit Hillel, then that's what you have to follow. a sense of trying to be machmir, to follow all opinions, mm-hmm. is not a good thing. This is actually discussed in Gemara Chulin Mem Gimel, 43, where the Gemara says, effectively, if you follow the Chumrot, the stringencies of Hillel and Shammai, you're considered a fool. And if you follow the leniencies of both, you're considered a rasha, you're considered someone who's wicked. But the point here is, once the halacha has been determined that the halacha is like Beit Hillel, mm-hmm. that's what you're that is what you are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And once halacha process is determined, this is what you're supposed to be doing, for you to then say, I'm now going to do this to fulfill the word of Beit Shammai, mm-hmm. is itself antinomian. Mm-hmm. You are going against the halachic process. Mm-hmm. If you happen to be lying down, yes, there'd be no chiyuv to get up. But for you to stop what you're doing specifically to fulfill what Beit Shammai said, that's already a no-no.
Mm-hmm. So then my much more practical follow-up, I always thought, you know, today, of course, current liturgy is the Shema. As I have, the Shema is always said sitting down, right?
Not always.
Not always.
I mean, people, even practically, people stand for Shema a bunch of times. For the most part, people happen to be sitting, uh-huh. right? But there are plenty of places where people are just, you know, stand for all of davening.
Okay.
Yeah, not sure how many, but mm-hmm. by numbers, sure. But that's just, you know, by convention.
Okay. So then we still do follow Beit Hillel after all.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Although the funny thing, you know, I actually, you know, had a friend at YU who I noticed specifically sat down for Maariv. I remember this clearly because we were davening in, it was back when at YU there was still a minyan on the fifth floor of the library. Mm-hmm. There still is a minyan at the library, just now in the really nice, like, lounge area, which would have been phenomenal if it was there when I was at YU. Not that I'm bitter. But anyway, I asked him about this. I was like, why did you sit down? He says, oh, because of B'shach B'cha. He says, ah, wonderful. And I quoted, you know, the Jami, that's Chayv Misa. You know, but I mean, I don't think it was actually Chayv Misa, you know, for wanting to sit down. But, you know, the point being, once this is the halacha is determined, then that's what you have to follow. So those are, you know, two examples that, you know, are more of human characteristics that relate more to, you know, I would say they're almost non-halachic problems. Like, one is an issue of not understanding a reality of the world around you, and the other is, you know, more of a personal choice type thing. Mm-hmm. Section 3 here, I wanted to throw in a few sources dealing with potential flaws in halachic transmission. And these get a little bit more complicated, and in some ways speak more to the source of rabbinic authority. One of the reasons why, Yair Cohen, we were discussing the sources of rabbinic authority, one approach is that there's an unbroken chain of transmission from Har Sinai, right, from Mount Sinai. Thus, any break or change there could, in theory, call into question rabbinic authority. Once you no longer have, you know, that clear linear progression, well, you know, at what point do you start doubting, and at what point does the system start unraveling? Mm-hmm. Interesting question to consider, but first, let's see a couple of sources that may demonstrate potential flaws in halachic transmission. Again, I should also point out here that we're not going to be discussing that the sources here don't necessarily need to be treated as historically accurate in terms of that this is something that actually happened, but rather it's at least a theoretic possibility that is discussed and the implications thereof. So first is a Gemara in Yoma, 80a. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yochanan said, standard measures and penalties are fixed by laws to Moses on Sinai. But the penalties are written out in Scripture. Rather, the minimum required for penalties is fixed by laws to Moses on Sinai. It was also taught thus, the minimum required for penalties are fixed by laws to Moses on Sinai. Others say the court of Jabez, whoever he is, fixed them. But Scripture said, these are the mitzvot, commandments, which means that no prophet is permitted to introduce any new law from then on. Rather, they were forgotten, and then they established them anew.
Right? Shichachum v'chazru v'yisidru. Right? So, you know, it's a weird, you know, type of statement here because, you know, you're talking here about a reconstruction. I mean, the answer seems to be, I mean, it's hard to say. It's interesting. I don't know if this last line is actually attributed to Rav Yochanan too, but you're still trying to go back. You're like, oh, it must be that they forgot it and then they brought it back. Well, how would you know that it was always there and then they forgot it and then brought it back? It seems like a weird type of statement to sort of retroject historically, but it is an important point to realize that it's mentioned here that certain laws were forgotten and then had to be reconstituted. But if they were forgotten, then... And you did have that break. How do you know if they were necessarily exactly what preceded it? It's not, and look, these are, the Gemaras all here, you know, warrant much greater explanation.
Right,
we've shown him deal with this in other commentaries.
Right.
But well, we've got a couple of more, you know, that I want to discuss that actually deal with this sort of thing. So next is a Gemara in Temura, 16a. The above text stated, Yehuda reported the name of Samuel. 3,000 traditional laws were forgotten during the period of mourning for Moses. They said to Joshua, ask. He replied, it is not in heaven. Then the Israelites said to Samuel, ask. He replied, scripture says, these are the commandments, implying that since the promulgation of these commandments, no prophet has now the right to introduce anything new, which we saw in Gemara and Yoma just above. So Rav Isaac the Smith said, Rav Isaac the Smith, also the law relating to a sin offering whose owners have died was forgotten during the period of mourning for Moses. They, the Israelites, said to Pinchas, ask. He replied to them, it is not as heaven. They said to Elazar, ask. He replied, these are the commandments, implying that the promulgation of these commandments, no prophet has now the right to introduce anything new. Have you reported the name of Rav? When Moses departed this world for the Garden of Eden, he said to Joshua, ask me concerning all the doubts you have. He replied to him, my master, have I ever left you 1 hour and gone elsewhere? Did you not write me concerning in the Torah, but his servant Joshua the son of Nun departed not out of the tabernacle? Immediately the strength of Moses weakened, and Joshua forgot 300 laws, and those and there arose in his mind 700 doubts concerning laws. Then all the Israelites rose up to kill him. The Holy One, blessed be He, then said to him, Joshua, it is not possible to tell you. Now go and occupy their attention in war. As it says, now after the death of Moses and the servant of their Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spake, and it further said, prepare you victuals for within 3 days, etc. It has been taught, 1,700 kal of the Chomer and Zeresh Shavah specifications of the scribes were forgotten during the period of mourning for Moses. Said Rav Bua, nevertheless, Otniel, the son of Knaz, restored these forgotten teachings as a result of his dialectics. And Otniel, the son of Knaz, the brother of Caliph, took it, and he gave him Aksa, his daughter, to his wife. Why is it in Kalatsa? Said Rav Yochanan, because whoever saw her was angry with his wife. Okay, bit of a non sequitur towards the end there. Take the next one here. It's a Gemara in Sukkot 20a.
For in ancient times when the Torah was forgotten from Israel, Esther came up from Babylon and established it. It was again forgotten, and Hillel the Babylonian came up and established it. Yet again was it forgotten, and Rabbi Ahiah and his sons came up and established it.
So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to take these up, and I want to put a pause here. Well, not pause the, you know, recording here, but just stop here for a moment. You have a few sources here that we've seen that deal with really serious breaks in the tradition. Some that happened pretty high up in the traditional chain, like in the time of, say, Moshe and Joshua. Yeah. And if you've got a break in the tradition there about something being forgotten, kal vachomer, logical inference, stuff can, you know, be messed up down the road too. Right? And it is, I mean, to just give one example here about, you know, I'll save the example for later, but suffice it to say for right now, it is the, when you're dealing with a human chain of transmission, it is possible for mistakes to come up or simply for people to forget things. Now, whether or not any of these are actual historically accurate, I don't know. Whether or not that the intent of these midrashim is to show that, oh, yes, there's a flaw in the Mesorah, there's a flaw in the tradition, unlikely. Because, you know, they see, oh, it is reconstituted. But if you're going to be, take this very strictly, well, you have multiple cases here that might lead someone to call into question, especially if you follow the assumption that, certainly if you are of the opinion that you have to take all of these agadot as literal historical fact, you've got some pretty big questions on the chain of transmission. keep that in mind. Next is the Gemara in Psachim, that deals with, I guess, sort of a flaw in transmission, but on a more human level. And in terms of historical, it's less of a, you may be able to take this as slightly more accurate than the previous ones that do seem to be retrojections or reinterpretations of history, things that happened, thousand some odd years before. So the Gemara in Psachim 66, our rabbis taught, the halacha was hidden from him, i.e. forgotten by B'nai Batria. There was a certain halacha about Korban Pesa what happens when, you'll see the question here in a second. On one occasion, the 14th of Nisan fell on Shabbat, and they forgot and they did not know whether the Passover overrides the Shabbat or not in terms of preparing the Korban. So here you have a case where an entire town just did not know a halacha, right? Again, possible flaw in the transmission, but all right, so keep that in mind. Said they, is there any man who knows whether the Passover rides the Sabbath or not? They were told, there's a certain man who has come up from Babylonia, Hillel the Babylonian by name, who served the two greatest men of the time, and he knows whether the Passover overrides the Sabbath or not. So I put in a dot, dot, dot. Galipsis gave him the answer. They were happy with it. They immediately set him at the head and appointed him Nasi, patriarch over them. It's great. We have a question. Ask this guy a question. It's like, yeah, great. You're hired as a rabbi. It's like very easy interview process. He was sitting and lecturing the whole day on the laws of Passover. Here's where it gets fun for us. He began rebuking them with words. Said he to them, what caused it for you that I should come up from Babylonia to be a Nasi over you? It was your indolence, because you did not serve the two greatest men of the time, Shemaiah and Avtalion. Okay, gave them a little bit of mussar. Said they to him, Master, what if a man forgot and did not bring a knife on the eve of the Sabbath? So, I have heard this law, he answered, but I have forgotten it. But leave it to the children of Israel. They are not prophets, they are the children of prophets. On the morrow, he whose Passover was a lamb, stuck it the knife in its wool. His Passover was a goat, stuck it between its horns. He saw the incident and recollected the halacha and said, thus I received the tradition for the mouths of Shemaiah and of Talion. Now, here you have instances of one of an entire town, not knowing a certain halacha. And then you also have Hillel, right, the Babylonian, who himself forgot a halacha. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, he was able to reconstruct it, but, excuse me, it is possible, simply, rabbis do forget things from time to time. Okay. Some, even the ones who have, and in fact, something, unfortunately, that I heard from some teachers, the ones who tend to have better memories as they get older tend to make more mistakes because they're not used to going back and checking up sources. Like, I have a bad memory. So for me, every time I want to cite something, I always have to go to a source because I don't trust my memory all that much. So for me, I'm still going to make mistakes, but, I just have a lot more self-doubt. There are occasions, though, when people who have such phenomenal memories, let's say they committed all of the Gemara to memory, and I'm fortunate to know some people like that, if as you just rely on your memory so much, it's much easier to make a mistake because you're not used to going back and checking up your sources. The way you remember it is the way you remember it. And unfortunately, that is a, and we're not even talking about, you forgot a particular source exists, just even remembering it incorrectly. Here you have a case where possibility one, is an entire town can forget a halacha. Now, granted, the halacha wasn't forgotten from all of Klal Yisrael, but in one particular town. Mm-hmm. But if halacha is forgotten in one particular town, and that particular town happens to be isolated, and they might even think that they're doing something okay or proper, and that's how they transmit down to future generations, mm-hmm. even though they're continuing a chain of transmission, it could be an error because of a flaw in that they've forgotten the initial law. Similarly with Hillel, Habavli, right? It is possible for a rabbi to forget a law. Mm-hmm. And it happens. The difference is, Hillel Bavli, at least here, had the integrity to at least admit it. And yes, there's a certain bit of irony where he says, you know, oh, your problem is because you didn't, you know, do enough shemesh. And that is an important consideration. That one flaw you can have in chains, in a certain chain of transmission, is people don't put in the work. And we could argue, you know, about quality of, like, you know, is this really transmission, or this, you know, this the tradition, or this not, or whatever. But not everyone, you know, who studies Torah does so equally. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, not just saying that some are smarter than others, some happen to be smarter than others, and some work harder than others. Mm-hmm. If you're not that smart and you don't work as hard, you're probably not going to get it right as often as someone who is smart and someone who does work hard. Mm-hmm. Right? There is a human component that does come up in flaws of transmission, mm-hmm. Either in terms of you know, academic aptitude or, you know, diligence in terms of transmitting things. In which case, you know, the previous Gemaras about, you know, certain laws were forgotten, you know, might kind of make sense, especially if you just got a whole bunch of laws like in day one and you're trying to cram everything in. There's another important consideration, which we have a Gemara in Sota 47b, also about Hillel and Shammai. Take this one.
When the disciples of Hillel and Shammai multiplied, who would not serve sufficiently, dissensions increased in Israel, and the Torah became like two Torahs.
Rabu machloket b'Yisrael and asit Torah k'shtei Torot. A very powerful line here, right? And why is it developed? Because shalosh shimasho kol tzorchan. An important component of halacha is shimush. Where you just, I mean, today it's more like an internship, but it's actually being out in the field. There's really no comparison between, say, you know, the book learning and the practical learning. In, you know, Shechita, there are, you know, separate laws about being a mumcha, knowing all the knowing all the laws, and being muhsak, of knowing how to actually perform the Shechita. For Shemush, you have to actually be out there. You have to serve your masters. You have to be with them, see how they operate, learn inductively. How do they answer certain questions and inquire, why did you do this here? Why did you do that there? It's a huge part of the learning process. YU actually requires 2 years of it. There's a third year Shemush and a fourth year Shemush. The fourth year one's a little bit more intensive. That's when, you know, you're working as, say, an intern in a shul. That's when you're, you know, when you actually go out into a classroom. It's a huge important component. Without that, it's very easy to make mistakes. Or if not make mistakes, where you would have errors or variations in tradition and in transmission. Because the experience of, say, a shul rabbi, or someone who's out there encountering a lot of real-world problems and knowing how people react, interact, and knowing the varieties of people that you could encounter, mm-hmm. is going to be very different than someone who never steps foot outside of the yeshiva. To give, you know,
these guys were allegedly just basically engaged too much in book learning, and or is that?
It's hard to say. It's either they engaged too much of it, or that they didn't do shemush enough or properly. To give, you know, my favorite analogies, two of them, similar analogies by two different rebbeim of mine independently. Chacham Faur, Yosef Faur, was my father's rabbi, and he gave the analogy of the difference between a law professor and a judge, right? Where a law professor, you know, he gave the particular analogy, like a law professor may understand the law much better than a judge, but a judge is the one who actually sets what the law is. He gave the analogy of, when he first told me this, it was 2002. He says, a law professor can give you all the best arguments why Al Gore ought to have won the election. Mm-hmm. But no law professor can say that Al Gore was the president of the United States. Related, Rav Moshe Tendler said, Chas v'shalom, God forbid, you want a Rosh Yeshiva making a psak for you. You want to make a Rosh Yeshiva to make a psak for you, like you want a mathematician to build your bridges. Said, sure, a mathematician can know the math better than an engineer, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean he knows how to build a bridge. A rab knows how to build a bridge. It's how do you take those concepts and apply it in the real world. That was his analogy. I think it does speak, you know, to something here, and would certainly explain for certain variations. But in all of these...
So the disciples were like mathematicians in Shammai and Hillel, or like engineers?
Well, I don't know exactly what happened, you know, what does it mean here, Shulah Shimashu Kol Tzorchan? The point more is that because of some deficiency within the students themselves, that deficiency then cascaded to machloka and to disputes in halacha. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just, and according to this interpretation, it wasn't that, oh, we have an ideological, dispute. Mm-hmm. Like, you and I can both read a text a certain way. There's actually a blame assigned in this Gemara and Sota. That it's not because that, oh, you and I have an honest disagreement of opinion. Mm-hmm. It's that they were not diligent enough in their studies. Mm-hmm. All right? And that's a very important point. Of course you can have, a break in tradition if people just aren't good at what, or even by, and by not good at what they do, it's because they just did a lousy job in their training. I kind of similar lines is, the fourth section here of, fourth section. You can actually have now errors in decision making. Now, forgetting about, the previous section was like, yes, there may be a flaw in the transmission for one reason or another that the Gemara seems to blame on, you didn't work hard enough. But there are also times when you may very well just get it wrong. That does happen. So first is a Gemara in Sanhedrin 33. Following contradicts this. If a man judged a case by himself and pronounced him who is liable, not liable, or vice versa, the clean, unclean, or the reverse, his decision stands, but he must pay indemnity out of his own pocket. Rabbi Yosef answered, this presents no difficulty. Here, our Mishnah refers to a mumcha, there to one who is no mumcha. But in the case of the mumcha, do we reverse the decision? Have we not learned? If he was recognized by the Beit Din as a mumcha, he is exempted from paying compensation. This is in the event that, a dayan that gives incorrect...
A mumcha is an expert, I assume?
Yes. In this case, I wouldn't just say expert as much as... yes, technically it would mean an expert, but here, someone who is considered a mumcha lebetin, I like using the term a licensed practitioner, meaning he has that certification that permits it. Like anyone, you can have three random people can be a patron, but a mumcha is like you've got certification as an expert that you really know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even so, all right. Nachman answered here in Mishnah. There's a court superior to this one in learning and numbers. Where's the other Mishnah? There is no court available superior to this in learning and numbers. Rav Sheshet had said, here it treats of a case where the judge erred regarding a law cited in Mishnah, in which case his decision may be revoked. There, the case where he erred in the weighing of conflicting opinions. We'll stop here for a moment. Goes a few descriptions behind it. The two idioms in Hebrew here is ta'ab dvar mishnah and ta'ab bishikul hadat. One would be if you actually got the source wrong, and the other is there's an argument of conflicting opinions and you pick the wrong one. And the Gemara then goes through and discusses the ramifications about... what cases would you actually like to not just reverse the positions, but also in terms of, paying back for making a bad decision. We're not going to go through the whole thing here. The main reason why I cited this is because Gemara and Sanhedrin recognizes the possibility that you can make errors in decision making, even if you're a dayan, even if you're serving as a judge, and even if you're a certified mumcha. Now, granted, if you are a mumcha, if you are certified by a Beit Din, you may be indemnified against certain liabilities, but that no way insulates you from making mistakes. And there's no pretense here of saying, oh, yes, our mumchas are infallible. Mm-hmm. And that is an incredibly important point. Mm-hmm. And the two cases here is like, yes, you could have a to'ebi dvar mishnah, or you could have to'ebi shikul hadat. You could err in terms of logic, and you could err in terms of getting a source wrong. Mm-hmm. It happens. It doesn't mean you are a bad person. It doesn't mean you are stupid. It means every now and again you have an off day. All right? Or something, it just happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right? Turn the page. All right, here's also, I mean, in terms of rabbinic fallibility, you know, these next couple of sources are what, you know, people really like, you know, really come to the forefront and normally where discussions like this start. First is Pasuk in Bemidbar, 15:24. Suppose the community sins without meaning to, and suppose they do not know they have sinned, then the whole community must offer a young bull. They must offer it for a burnt offering. Give a smell that is pleasant to the Lord. Along with it, they must offer its required grain offering and drink offering. Also, a male goat for the sin offering. Right? So this... one second. Right. According to First Mishnah and Harayot, in terms of the description here, if the court ruled that any one of the ritual commandments mentioned in the Torah may be transgressed, and an individual proceeded and acted through error in accordance with their ruling, whether they acted thus and he acted with them, or they acted and he acted after them, or even if they did not act as he acted, he is exempt because he relied on the ruling of a court. If, however, when the court issued an erroneous ruling, one of them, who knew they had erred, or a disciple, who himself was capable of deciding matters of law, proceeded and acted in accordance with their ruling, whether they acted or he acted with them, or they acted and he acted after them, they did not act and he acted, he is liable, since he was not dependent on the ruling of the court. This is the general rule. He who is in a position to rely on himself is subject to a penalty, and only he who must depend on the court is exempt. And Gemara, you know, later on explains, based on the pasuk in Bemidbar, that it would have to be kol ha'ida, that the entire community, meaning if the Sanhedrin did not rule unanimously, then they would not bring this korban. But if there was dissension, the korban would only be brought if the entire Sanhedrin made the mistake. It's a matter of unanimous decision. Then it would really be kol ha'ida. Once it's no longer unanimous, then individuals would still be held liable. According to this, someone who acts, you know, is relying on the court, you know, he would, you know, be tagged along, he would be exempt because he relied on the ruling of Beit Din. But if you know that they made a mistake and you, you know, can stand it dependently, you know, fine. Now, this does lead to a whole bunch of other questions.
Right, like, how do you know in the Sanhedrin?
Yeah, and there was an article written in a Beit Yitzchak by a Rabbi Clapper, who's now up in Boston, about Zakei Mamre. You know, because on one hand, like, you know...
What's that?
Rebellious elder. Someone who goes against. So, it kind of puts you in a catch-22 of like, well, you're supposed to do with it, you know, you're supposed to follow the judgments, but what if they actually made a mistake? Point is, of including all this, and important to read the, you know, first few pages of Harayot, describe what happens when the Sanhedrin makes a mistake. And it's important to have, you know, and I think it's actually very crucial, you know, a few pages in the Gemara from a perspective of rabbinic integrity. It's very easy, you know, to bash the rabbis saying that they were power hungry, but when you acknowledge that you can make mistakes, and you actually have procedures for what happens when they make mistakes, as I see it, it's not the same as saying, like we saw in the previous class, that the Holy Spirit is coming down and speaking through the hands of the rabbis, and they are in fact acting. There is a sense, even amongst the rabbinic sages, that there is a higher law, that there is some objective standard that even they can be held accountable towards, and that there are things that they cannot say, and there are going to be boundaries to which they themselves are also held, such that their authority is not so sweeping that they can in fact alter reality, and that there is some accountability there. And if there is accountability, there at least is the theoretic possibility that people can make mistakes. All right? So you put all of these together, even though, right, the rabbis do represent some extension of divine authority, there is a possibility for them to make mistakes in any number of ways. We saw four examples here. One is not getting the mitzvah, the reality of the question that's faced in front of them. People on their own can just act incorrectly. And it's important to consider that because there are enough gemaras that base halacha on what a particular rabbi did or didn't do in certain cases. You can have flaws in transmission. I forgot to give a story about the flaw in transmission. Keep forgetting. There was I did a when I was studying with one of my professors in Revel, Talmud, we were discussing a particular sugya. And the professor thought that there was something weird about this sugya because you had two Amoraim that both studied with the same Rav and both came out with really opposite opinions. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was something weird that wouldn't happen. And I raised my hand and I said, well, what about Rav Soloveitchik? He's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you've been here. I mean, did this at YU. He's like, you've been here long enough. How many students did Rav Soloveitchik have? And how many different opinions are ascribed to Rav Soloveitchik from people who came out of the very same shiur? Mm-hmm. And I remember he looked at me, and he changed his notes. And I was very proud of myself, because this was a class that he gave over and over and over again. He actually was like, you know what, that's a good point. Made a little edit there. You know, you could have flaws in transmission. Simply because people can interpret things in different ways. Rav Soloveitchik is a wonderful example of that, because people paint Rav Soloveitchik, you know, say, well, here's what he said, and, you know, here's what he really meant. And any, you know, I guess this would apply to any Rav or any Gadol, any great rabbi.
That's how you know somebody's a great rabbi, when everybody's claiming him as their own.
But it's not just claiming them as your own. You sort of, like, need to recreate them in your image, because you invest so much in him. It's like, oh, here's what he, and if he says something, and I actually have it, it's like, oh, well, here's what so-and-so really meant when he said X, Y, and Z, because, you know, instead of actually saying, well, my conception might need to be altered, it's like, no, it's, if this text doesn't jive with my preconceived notions of who he is, then the text must mean something else, as opposed to, well, maybe I have to change my perceptions of someone. And I know with Rav Soloveitchik, people are incredibly territorial about it, which is why, a main reason why I've never given a shiur on Rav Soloveitchik here. I haven't got a request for it, because I just can't even begin to touch that. But you could see this happen enough that, you know, people come from the same shiur today can, you know, just come out with so many, you know, different ideas. It's a flaw in transmission, and it's a way that people can make a mistake. Mm-hmm. Now, and, you know, there are enough, you know, we saw a bunch of Gemaras here that do get this human fallibility across, either from forgetting certain halachot, again, don't need to know if it was historically accurate that this is what happened, but, you know, it's mentioned too many times for it to just be ignored. An individual rabbi can forget something, and you may just have, you know, people who just are not that diligent or not that studious, who, even if what the rabbi said was absolutely clear, if you're dozing off in the middle of shiur, you're not going to remember it actually, you know, correctly. Right, and then you start teaching it, you can start teaching things incorrectly too. And then finally, you just plain have people make mistakes in decision making. That simple. So, right, so those are the four types of varieties. Now, in terms of implications for Jewish law, huge, huge question, you know, for any one of these, which, you know, we're not going to, I don't think there's a set answer today, but it's an important step as we, you know, we'll move on in terms of how does halacha work. And we'll probably get to a different aspect of that next week. All right. Have a wonderful week. Be well.